I'm Will Hutton, and you're listening to the We Society podcast. I'm a journalist, writer, economist, and a fierce advocate of the social sciences. Now, more than ever, we need to be listening to those with solutions to our world's ills, whether that's climate change, the cost of living crisis, or something more granular, like the low uptake of sport in certain communities that could damage the health and well-being of an entire country. And you'll be hearing conversations with top social scientists who are addressing just these issues in the We Society podcast. They'll be bringing us some of the best ideas to shape the world we live. As the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, I know how vital the social sciences are to ensuring we are a society of we and not an island of I. Social scientists are the hidden heroes behind government policy, city planning conundrums, and top business decisions. By engaging with some of the best new ideas, I sincerely believe that our world can be much improved. I hope you enjoy the We Society podcast, brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Britain was the first country to industrialise. In 1870, we were the richest country in the world. Since then, it's been downhill, with the decline of anything intensifying over the last 15 years. Productivity and investment have stagnated. The Bank of England considers our long-run growth rate to have sunk below 1% a year. What's going on? Can we recover our dynamism? Maybe being the first to industrialise was not such a great idea. It meant we never had to think hard about how to build a dynamic economy. What lessons are there from our history? With me to discuss these issues is Britain's preeminent economic historian, Professor Nick Crafts, at the University of Sussex after distinguished spells at Oxford, LSE and Warwick, with two books and 100 referred articles under his belt, and now president of the Royal Economic Society. The world beats a path to his door, and we followed suit here at his home in Hove. Professor Nick Crafts, welcome to the We Society podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Nick, when we contacted you to kind of be interviewed for the We Society podcast, and you heard this name, We Society, what was your first thought of We Society? What did you think about? What was your reaction to that kind of concept?
My reaction to the concept was, I'm very pleased they want to talk to me. I'm rather surprised.
Well, I hope that when we finish, people will not be surprised at why we're here. Britain first to industrialise, it all seems so easy. And it's got more and more difficult as the decades have gone by to where we are today. Is there any linkage between that?
Britain was the first country to industrialise, to go through the Industrial Revolution. That wasn't easy, actually. It was the culmination of many centuries of slow development. But it was certainly something in which we led the world, and that was a fine accomplishment. Although one might say, in a way, it's not a particularly sophisticated economy. You know, the first motor car, the Model T or something like that, was a great achievement, but we wouldn't drive one today. Similarly, the institutions, the education system, the standard of entrepreneurship, probably all those things are things which we would say were very good for the time, but not good enough for later on. So the question then is whether success in the early phase actually makes it more difficult, or whether subsequently, or whether it's simply that adjustment was needed. It could have happened, but we didn't really do it. But one way or the other, you would have needed to adjust. It's true that some of the roots of institutions, which I think did turn out to be problematic carriers of history, industrial relations being one, the system of corporate governance, I think, being another. The roots do date back to the Industrial Revolution, and I've written certainly things which suggest that the early start did indeed, in the end, prove to be a bit of a handicap.
Certainly, I mean, working on it as I have been over the last kind of few months, I've been thinking that more and more. I mean, it didn't have to be the case that industrial relations were quite as adversarial as they got to. It didn't have to be the case that actually companies were governed in the way they were and that actually the supply of external finance was as kind of primitive as it was. I mean, so that, I mean, when Germany and the United States kind of overtook us in the last decade of the 19th century, first decade of the 20th century, we just didn't know how to respond, although we did. I mean, there was the famous Macmillan Committee, and they had very kind of serious recommendations, but somehow just kind of washed over the British establishment, who were kind of convinced all you had to do was free trade, small state, laissez-faire, adhere to the gold standard, and all would be well. But all wasn't well.
Well, it's certainly true that the Victorians were a small state economy. It's a slight abuse of the term, but you might almost say laissez-faire. The government provided defence, law and order, and so on, but wasn't terribly ambitious and liked to operate on the basis of rules, and you've mentioned a couple there. The gold standard and the balanced budget were two very obvious things. I think we did, in the interwar period, start to change really very quickly towards a more managed kind of economy. And indeed, that phrase can, I think, be used by the time of the 1930s for the development strategy that was adopted to try and recover from the shock of the Depression. I think the issue may be, and certainly in my second book I tried to spell this out, that moving to a more managed economy took away a lot of competition. In the absence of competition, some of those institutions we were just talking about malfunctioned. Competition allowed industrial relations to deteriorate, possibly even encouraged it. Lack of competition also was a handicap in holding management to account. So when we think of things which went wrong with British industry, I tend to suggest that it's an interaction between lack of competition by the time that comes about and the institutional legacy. So I think we can see ourselves changing, but the change doesn't work very well.
We're going to spool on to discuss today in a minute, but just let's poke about a little bit in this kind of area that you've raised. You know, I mean, 1931 to 1950 is in many respects quite an extraordinary period of British economy. I mean, the economy of 1930 was, you know, recognisably the late Victorian economy. But 1950, I mean, it's consumer durables, it's cars, it's jet engines, it's radar, it's the modernisation was breathtaking, and actually it's quite interesting to think of, to reflect on why that took place. I mean, it wasn't just that we needed to win a war against Germany. I mean, there was a de facto an industrial strategy there, which actually the Conservative Party under Balfour and then Baldwin, you know, really went for, and then followed through by the Labour government. I mean, is there a lesson? A, do you agree with that? And you probably don't, but to the extent that you do agree with that, are there lessons for us now in 2023?
We did eventually, in the interwar period, start to benefit from the technologies of the Second Industrial Revolution. You do see things like cars and electricity making a difference. That's correct. But I think insofar as industrial policy is concerned, although it pretended to be interested in what was called rationalisation, which might be a word these days we'd replace with modernisation or something like that, the industrial policy of the 1930s is very defensive, and it's actually aimed at protecting or helping failing industries. So it's promoting cartels in things like coal and what would have happened in cotton had things gone a little bit further. It's developing a regional policy which is trying to ameliorate high unemployment, but it's certainly not restructuring the regions which are struggling as their export industries have to confront deglobalisation and so on. There is a real change in the post-war years, the Attlee government and so on. But I think it's hard to see the Attlee government as having a long-term industrial strategy. I think their hands are full with trying to deal with the aftermath of World War II. The very really difficult balance of payments situation that was obvious at the time really dominated, I think, anything to do with long-term thinking. They had ideas about how to change the way the economy ran, most obviously to nationalise quite a significant part of the economy. We're probably talking about 10 to 12% of the economy being in nationalised industries. But did they have a strategy for what those industries should do? Not a convincing one, I don't think.
Well, I do find it extraordinary looking back. I mean, there we were, you know, 1780 to 1860, you know, the Great Exhibition of Crystal Palace being one component of that, you know, the most dynamic capitalist economy, you know, on the face of the earth. And then 150 years later, you simply can't say that. Again, it kind of grips with actually, you know, what, I mean, some of it was inevitable because, you know, other countries were bound to get richer, so there's that. But actually, a long run growth rate of 1% or below is not great. That's where we stand now.
Yeah, I mean, thinking first of all about the period of the Industrial Revolution.
It was a long-run growth rate, 1%, you'd say.
Well, it's a long period of slow acceleration of growth. We don't reach a 1% a year growth rate for productivity until the second quarter of the 19th century. We briefly touched 2% in that third quarter, but we're essentially an economy which is capable of growth that they wouldn't have dreamt of in the 16th century, but it's a relatively modest kind of growth rate compared with what we saw in many countries, including our own, in the 20th century. We have had periods where we've grown quite a lot more rapidly than that during the 20th century, and the peak phase was the so-called golden age, the period between, say, about 1950 and the mid-1970s. Labour productivity growth in that period is nearly 4% a year. We were able to grow at a labour productivity increase of about 2% a year in the 30 or 40 years before the financial crisis. That's way above anything they could have done through most of the Industrial Revolution. But the roof certainly has fallen in the last 15 years or so. If we were or are looking at a future of 1% a year growth in the future, perhaps 1% a year productivity growth with the labour force not growing a lot, then that would be a very disappointing outcome. I'm not convinced that that is the long-term future, but I can quite see why it's reasonable for some people to believe that it will be.
Why? I guess that's the question, really. I mean, everybody listening to this was saying, well, why? Come on, Will, ask him why.
So I am. Why might we do better?
Well, why has it gone?
Why
has it gone pear-shaped?
I think it's gone pear-shaped for a number of reasons. It's not a one-reason story. The financial crisis did do considerable damage. It has reduced the level of productivity that the economy can achieve compared with not having a financial crisis.
But it hits us more than, say, the United States or more than, you know, many European
economies. It hits us more than most European countries. We had a very large financial sector prior. But we also have had a serious disruption to what we might call the process of creative destruction and so on. So that's a bit of
just so you know, creative destruction is the kind of term that was coined by Schumpeter. The Austrian economist. And the idea is that, you know, capitalism has to go through phases in which it pulls down great companies so other ones can grow up?
I think I'm really not thinking of anything quite as grand as that. I'm thinking
I wanted to make you feel grand.
I'm thinking of a vigorous process of entry and exit, reallocation of resources, rapid exit of the failing activity, lots of startups of new good activities.
There are lots of startups. I mean, it's astonishing number of startups.
Yeah, but there's also been a substantial number of zombie firms. The era of low interest rates allows them to survive. If you look at measures of entry and exit, it's been decreasing over the last several years. So I'm not saying that's the whole story, but I think it's part of the story. A second part of the story is clearly, for me, Brexit, in the sense that, not that we've reached the long-term conclusion of Brexit, some of the long-term effects are still to show up, but the actual process of going through the leaving creates very significant uncertainty, undermined investment, and the best estimates I've seen in the literature say if we've got a 20% productivity gap compared with where we might have hoped to be round about 2019 on previous form, then the Brexit part of it might well account for 5 of those 20%, something of that order. The one that I think most...
Of course, if John Redwood was here, or Lord David Frost, they'd be saying, look, you're just not seizing the opportunities of Brexit. You're just not talking it up. You're just a Ramoning pessimist, you know. That's what they would say if they were here.
Well, perhaps they should look at the empirical evidence and think about the theory of how investment works. We know that uncertainty is a really major handicap for an economy in terms of investment. We know that not knowing how Brexit would pan out was an important source of uncertainty. I refer you to the survey done by the Bank of England, by the Stanford economics team for the Bank of England, which I think provided a compelling case that there's a big productivity cost to that. I prefer evidence to assertion. The third one, which I think hasn't had as much attention as it might, and is sort of hidden a bit in the arcane, the weeds, if you like, of productivity performance, is the waning of the new economy ICT revolution, which we did pretty well at. We were good with that technology by most European standards. That gave us quite a strong underpinning to productivity growth in the 1990s, around the turn of the century. I think it's starting to ebb away as the financial crisis comes along. The arithmetic I've done suggests that the slowdown in the productivity impact of ICT, IT, call it what you will, has probably knocked about 0.9% a year off our productivity growth rate, might account for nearly half of the slowdown. Now, if that diagnosis is right, then you might say, okay, that's a technology we exploited pretty well. Is there something to replace it? If there's something to replace it, it might be the next phase, in a sense, of that revolution coming through things like AI, artificial intelligence. We're excited about it at the moment. It's had, I suspect, virtually no productivity impact. But then these big general purpose technologies, that's the history of them. People get excited. They know the technology's coming, so to speak, well before it has any serious economic impact. I'm forecasting that for AI. It was the story of the Industrial Revolution as well. The steam engine made essentially no difference to British productivity before 1830.
And just to kind of help our listeners, a general purpose technology, and there's been around 30 of them since, 10,000 BC, are the technologies which have a kind of a transformative impact, not just in the sector, but actually kind of spillovers, across sectors. So, railway locomotives are great in getting you from A to B, but they also kind of open up the world with grain, they change warfare, they allow postal services develop, they all have all kinds of spillover. So you're saying that, I mean, and there's quite an interesting theory, isn't there? Because we're kind of forging our personologies in the 18th century, 19th century, and eight in the 20th. And people are saying there could be a dozen or more in the 21st century. And the artificial intelligence is one of them. But you're saying that may or may not be the case. If it is the case, beware, because it does take a while for them to get going, having their impact.
Yeah, I'm saying that the history suggests that there are time lags before the technology becomes, whichever this big technology is, becomes economically important. We can see the potential, but we have a wait before the potential is realised.
Just a quick break in the conversation to tell you more about the organisation behind the We Society podcast. We champion the social sciences and highlight the important role academics and practitioners have in all sectors of our society, whether that's business, health, government, education. The list is endless. It currently feels like the world's in a state of flux as we grapple with the ongoing war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, spiralling energy costs, climate change. The social sciences have a vital role to play in improving lives, and this podcast brings you the best ideas to shape the way we live. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read upon our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. So it could be going through a lull, in your view. It could be a kind of, this could be the lull before things get a great deal better.
There could be something of a lull, yeah. Don't forget how pessimistic people were about productivity performance in the United States in the 1980s. There was Robert Solow saying at the time...
Professor of Economics, Robert Solow, yeah.
Yeah, we can see the computer everywhere except in the productivity statistics.
That's a great line, wasn't it?
Very 1987, famous. A decade later, you could see it in the productivity statistics very, very strongly.
In what ways would artificial intelligence then kind of transform productivity?
Well,
what would
I think one really interesting thing is it might deliver a new industrial revolution if we interpret the concept of the industrial revolution as the invention of a new system of invention. If we think of that, the first industrial revolution is about, I think, measurement, it's about becoming more empirical.
It's coal and steam, is it? Right? Yeah.
No, but it isn't a revolution built on science, really. You know, they have the steam engine, but they don't really understand the theory of heat, for argument's sake. They have metallurgy without the theory behind it.
They're good old-fashioned English pragmatists, is what they would say at the time.
And empirical observers. Yeah, they systematically build up evidence and try and work out what works.
Yeah.
By the second industrial revolution...
Which is essentially electricity and chemicals.
Yeah, this is from, say, about 1870... You can see it underway, and it's indeed delivering chemicals, electricity, the internal combustion engine, and so on.
That's petrol, though, isn't it? Because the third industrial revolution is to do with oil and carbon.
Well, it depends how many you want to choose. But if you're following my system of invention...
Well,
approach,
I want to follow your system,
good.
Actually.
Well, in that case, the second industrial revolution is about the beginnings of a really important role for the industrial R&D laboratory. Now you need to have people educated as scientists and technologists. Now you need to have the infrastructure at, say, the tertiary education level to deliver enough of those people.
Right.
That's where we start falling behind the Americans and the Germans. We're not good at making that adjustment or adaptation. The third industrial revolution arguably is the ICT one, and ICT starts to deliver new ways of doing research, amongst other things, and software makes a massive difference to the system of invention. AI is another potential system of invention. One of my economic historian colleagues said, amongst other things, AI might be the best research assistant the world has ever had. If you're looking for needles in haystacks, smaller needles and bigger haystacks is definitely available now.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it, because I've always assumed the topology that I have in my head, I think in other people's heads as well, is, you know, first industrial revolution, steam, coal, second industrial revolution, chemicals, electricity, third industrial revolution, oil, petrol, fourth industrial revolution, data, which kind of encompasses both ICT and AI. But you're saying, that's not the way to think about it. I mean, the way to think about it is to kind of separate out ICT and AI.
I would probably separate them out, but the more important thing I'm saying is that industrial revolutions are about how technological progress comes about. We can itemize some of the technologies they give rise to, but the difference in general purpose technologies between, if you want to roll together data and AI, I'll go with that if you like, that is something which is adding to the process of invention. The steam engine is jolly good at carrying people, pumping water out of mines, powering textile factories, but it doesn't help you find more knowledge across the piece, whereas data and AI do.
Give us a sense, and just a kind of future scope for a minute, give us a kind of window into the Nick Crafts mind. I mean, 10, 20 years' time, what kinds of technology do you think will be underpinning our economy? Where will the jobs be? What can we do to make sure we get our fair share of those, or more than our fair share? I mean, what can we do as a country to kind of, you know, be in there fighting for at the frontiers of this and building great companies out of it and all the rest?
Come on, Will, I'm an economic historian, so I'm only good at looking backwards, not forwards.
No, occasionally, come on. As you wander out of your books to have a cup of tea, you must think,
The semi-serious answer to your question is I don't know. And that's quite an important thing, to know that you don't know. If you don't exactly know which of the jobs which will disappear and the new ones come along, which we've perhaps not dreamt of some of them, then what you need to have is a system which can adapt and be flexible when the time comes. That tells you, I think, something about how you want to educate people. It tells you something about how you might handle the process of creative destruction, to go back to that phrase again. It seems to me you've got to persuade people to be willing to accept that creative destruction is part of a successful capitalist economy, in which case you've got to deal with issues to do with what happens to them when they do lose their job.
Yeah.
And to deal with that in a way which offers them true social insurance and an active labour market policy to go with it, to help them into redeployment. The key thing making success of some transformative technology is that you don't end up with the displaced workers unemployed, you have them redeployed. And that is, I think, how we should position ourselves for a future we can't know in terms of what exactly it will be that comes along and exactly what disappears.
This point you've made about distinguishing between jobs and worker is I hear you talk, I think to myself, you know, the rise of kind of late 19th century trade unionism and early 20th century trade unionism. I mean, they wanted to protect workers, obviously, but actually, because unions are unions of people who hold jobs, it always ended up being job protection rather than worker protection. And so that's a long shadow, actually, isn't it? It's kind of very deep in our culture, I think.
I think it is.
Now, look, let's round this off. Let's pull this together, because, you know, you've been talking here for half an hour. I began this asking, you know, can we recover our dynamism? Can we do better than the last 15 years? Because it's a very kind of doleful picture. I mean, not great.
I know lots of young people are kind of, you know, worrying about getting married, whether they should leave the country. I mean, it seems to be going nowhere. But on the other hand, there's reservoirs of possibility. Where are you on this? Are you an optimist? Is relative decline going to continue?
You could be an optimist in terms of thinking that the productivity growth rate might improve or will improve without necessarily thinking that that would end relative economic decline. Relative economic decline is about having productivity growth rates which are slower, lower than your peer group, whoever it is you're comparing your progress with. I am optimistic because I do think there is scope for another resurgence of technological progress in the economy.
But you're essentially you're saying there are things to be done. I've itemised them. There's a lot of new technology going to be around the rest of the world, which we will import, and I hope we'll do well with it. Whether we'll do better than others is an open question.
Yeah. That sums it up very nicely.
Nick Cross, thank you very much. Thank you very much for a fascinating kind of 40 minutes in which we have looked at the Industrial Revolution, in which you've reminded us that it was slow burn and that the growth rate wasn't very fast. It was just happened year after year after year, which hadn't happened ever before then. You've discussed the second and third Industrial Revolutions and described how we lack the institutions to kind of exploit them well and thus fallen behind. You've told us that the productivity gap that we currently have is partly about Brexit, partly because we had an oversized financial services sector which was hit by the financial crisis, and partly because we were doing well with information communication technology, but that seems to have tailed away. But it's an open question whether we'll manage to kind of recover our place in the League of Nations. But we might do well enough to be a prosperous country and a happy country. So that's the thought to end on. Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch. And it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.